The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. We are going back to Napa Valley, to Beaulieu Vineyard, the general manager, the senior winemaker. It is Nate Wise. Nate, thank you so much for doing the pod.
Oh, my pleasure, Matt. Great to be here.
Yeah, the funny thing is we were talking right before, and I told you I'm a sports talk radio host, and you were joking, saying I'm your hero. You make killer Cabernet. You're kind of my hero as well.
Well, mutual admiration then. That's a great thing to have.
So let's start here. Your vineyard was not a planned trip last year when I was there. And I obviously know about BV. And we pulled in and I hadn't really tried many of the wines and was blown away by it. Like just the acidity, the freshness, it did not taste heavy. And where I wanted to start is, there are certain winemakers and certain vineyards get a bad reputation because they're in Napa and because they're not quote unquote boutique. So then people can have a stereotype of what they expect on the fruit profile, the body and the alcohol and all that.
Oh, I don't know. You know, speaking specifically of Beaulieu, we don't have a bad reputation. No, we've got this history of having opened originally in 1900 and having played a huge part in the development of Napa and California winemaking. So,
yeah,
I don't know about bad reputations necessarily, but, you know, we're not a tiny, tiny winery. Neither are we a huge winery, of course.
By the way, you're right. Like it was cool. Like just seeing so much of the history of Napa is within the vineyard. I guess it sort of goes to the bigger picture one. There's so much great Napa Cab that I love. And I think sometimes there's a stereotype, much like German Riesling. People get afraid of sweetness. I think there can be a misconception about Napa Cab that sometimes it is like a blanket sort of stereotype for people that maybe just haven't done the investigating.
We're not a huge appellation, you know. Napa Valley's there's about 40,000 acres of vineyard altogether, which is actually not that big. And there's a nice diversity, you know. There's a lot of sub appellations that have very different styles of wine. So it's tough to paint kind of broad strokes about what Napa Valley in general is doing these days, I would say, because the more you look for it, and the more you get into the weeds about what different people are doing in different areas, you know, the more diversity of style you're going to find.
Yeah, it's true. Like Calistoga versus Rutherford, the higher up you go in the mountains will give you one profile, closer to the valley will give you something else. We can nerd out about that in a second, but I want to hear more about you. I'd love to hear more about your childhood and how it impacted where you are today. I read you grew up in Napa. Your father was a winemaker. I'd love to hear how your childhood led to you being where you are right now.
You know, I grew up in St. Helena, which is about 6 or 7 miles north of BD, where I'm sitting right now. And my dad was a winemaker. You know, he started in the 70s. And like everybody in the 70s, he worked for Robert Mondavi and ultimately spent the last 25 years of his career at Groff in Oakville. And, you know, it's some of my earliest memories are during harvest time my mom would take me up to the winery during harvest and the smells and the sounds and running around on the catwalks above the tanks and seeing people working and doing pump overs and all sorts of stuff and watching the bottling line. You know, those are very core vivid memories for me, as well as, you know, kind of like walking to school. So I'd walk to school, my elementary school, and oftentimes I'd take a shortcut, you know, through a vineyard, which to me seems totally normal. But I'm sure in retrospect, you know, in the larger picture, you know, people are going, man, that is pretty cool. I think growing up around it, it feels so natural being here. And it wasn't until I really left the Napa Valley and went off to college and university and did various other things in my lifetime that I really realized what a special place this is and how bad I really wanted to come back to raise my own family and start my own career.
It is beautiful. It's stunning no matter where you go. But it's like that in so many wine areas. If you're in a well-known, even not well-known wine area, it's probably going to be pretty. So you grew up with it. How did that I'd love to hear just about the transition from as a kid loving being around it to, being a cellar rat at Groff Vineyard. How
Sure.
you decided this was going to be the job for me.
Well, I think like any kid that grew up in a wine area or here in the Napa Valley would probably tell you the first thing you want to do is you want to get out, right? You want to go
Of
do something
course.
else.
Of course.
So I ended up going to college down in the Central Coast of California at the University of California in Santa Barbara, which thoroughly enjoyed. Not a bad place to live in and of its own. But I was probably, 19-ish and kind of figuring out what I wanted to do and realizing that, I wasn't going to play in the NBA and, I was going to have to work for a living. And thinking about all the different options I had, I was kind of a science guy. I was interested in just because that's what I liked. I didn't really want to go to medical school, didn't really want to work for biotech or anything like that. And I found myself thinking about what my dad did, wearing jeans to work, playing with tractors and forklifts and stuff like that. And so when I graduated, I ended up coming back and working for him at the winery as a cellar rat. And those were, some of the best times of my life. It was actually, I look back now and I was early 20s. I had a serious girlfriend who's now my wife of 23 years. And, making $14 an hour or something like that, but cleaning presses and digging tanks and getting dirty and sweating all day and driving the tractor with the pumice spreader after it, that was really where I fell in love with this whole thing. And that was kind of the idea was work a harvest, see if you actually like it. I absolutely loved it. And I remember specifically the night I was driving the tractor through the vineyard with the pumice spreader on the back, and I was spreading all the pumice from the day's work, like the last press load. Sun was going down, jackrabbits were running around, there was a hawk in the sky, and I was like, I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be.
That must have been a great feeling to have that sense of purpose, that sense of knowing what you want to do. That's a hard thing for anyone when they're young. And then you also have the added bonus of the relationship because now it's a family thing as well. And you're at a time when you're learning a ton and you don't have the same amount of responsibility that you would in your current job.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I was green enough to, I didn't even know what I didn't know at that point, which actually, that's a great place to be. You're sort
It
of
is.
just along for the ride and figuring it out as you go, learning new stuff every day. And yeah, it was a really, really great time in my life, I gotta say.
Explain to people how much of a role is cleaning to making wine? How much is just cleaning things? What percentage is that of winemaking?
There's the estimate's hard to make, but the old adage goes it's like 90% cleaning, 2% actual making wine, and then the last 8% is drinking beer at the end of the day.
Those percentages check out. Some of the most famous winemakers here in Niagara, I've seen them with a push broom at 6 p.m. on a Sunday night, in the cellar. So that percentage checks out. How do you get to Silver Oak?
It was a fun journey. Honestly, it was sort of once you realize you really enjoy this, you want to do it for a living, then it becomes time to start learning. And I
Right.
know you have a diploma from WSET. You start learning about wines of the world. You start learning about wine in general. I decided to go back to school. I went to UC Davis and got a degree in winemaking and sort of my career, as everybody's does, kind of takes twists and turns. I worked actually for Etude for a bit out of graduate school. I was the assistant winemaker for Patson Hall for a bit. I got my first big break with Antinori, as that was my first real winemaking job. And then in 2014, had the good fortune to hook up with Silver Oak. They were looking for a successor to Daniel Barron, who was the second winemaker in Silver Oak's history, and I was in the right place at the right time, and it all worked out.
It's interesting. You started Etude, which is a great Pinot house. Now you're now at Silver Oak, and then currently, obviously, at Beaulieu, which are just, iconic Cabernet. What's the difference in terms of mindset, in terms of winemaking, all that, from going from Pinot to Cab?
That was an intentional decision on my part early in my career that I wanted to focus on Pinot because I think Pinot Noir is a little less forgiving in general. I think you have to be a little bit more at the top of your game when it comes to farming, when it comes to viticultural techniques, when it comes to fermentation and aging and things like that. And also, wine I really enjoy to drink. But I went with Etude early on out of school because not only did they do some great Pinot Noirs, but They also had access to some wonderful Cabernet vineyards. So my first harvest working for Etude was actually in the vineyards. So I got to, in the morning, I got to be in parts of Carneros looking at some of the best Pinot Noir there was in that part of the valley. And then in the afternoons, I'd be up valley looking at Cabernet Sauvignon and some of the best vineyards around for that. So I think the difference is that Pinot was a great place to kind of like earn your chops, like really get into the details and dive into the little nitty gritty of it all, which helps inform your decision making later on as I started to focus on Cabernet Sauvignon.
Let's skip ahead to Beaulieu. What first off, what do people need to know? You mentioned it off the top because you guys are famous and historic. What would you say are the main talking points of the history of where you're working now and the importance in terms of what your winery is to the history of California wine?
Yeah, and George de la Tour founded Beaulieu, otherwise known affectionately as BB in general. It founded it in 1900, and he was actually like an incredible entrepreneur at the time. He'd actually come to the valley to start another business, sort of wine adjacent. He was scraping tartrates off the insides of tanks, making cream of tartar out of it, and selling it to bakers and things like that. And was successful and decided to buy a vineyard here right here in Rutherford, the vineyard that we still farm called BB1, and set up BV in 1900 to start making wine. That was the get-go. Was able to survive Prohibition, so that was really one of the first critical parts of BV's history. Was he was able to survive Prohibition by selling sacramental wine to various different parishes throughout the United States. Which meant he was one of maybe four or five different people still in business during that period here in the US. Coming out of Prohibition, another really critical thing in our history was that he recruited Andre Chelechef from the Pasteur Institute in France to come to California. So Andre Chelechef arrived in 1938, became ultimately sort of the godfather of California winemaking. He has this sort of mentorship tree that's gigantic, all these different people that he influenced all up and down the West Coast, and really one of the most influential winemakers probably in California and Napa Valley history. So, we've got this 125 years in 2025. It was our anniversary. Since then, Andre officially retired in the 70s, came back, but ultimately passed away in 94. So since then, we've been building upon that legacy. We're best known for the George de la Tour Private Reserve, which is a wine named after the founder, which we've been making since 1936. So this year will be the 91st vintage of that wine.
Did you feel pressure when you went over there? Because you obviously are going to have your own philosophies, your own styles, and they're going to mesh a lot with what BV is doing. But at the same time, you're entering this historic place, but you're going to want to put your own personality on the wines. I'm wondering, what sort of transition was that like for you?
There is a lot of pressure. It's a big legacy. Since Andre, there's only been a handful of winemakers that have really run BV. But at the same time, I was used to that. I had the same situation at Silver Oak, where I was part of a lineage from Justin Meyer to Daniel Barron. And so I was very used to that and had been through this before. And so I think you don't come in expecting to put your own imprint on it, right? When you have a winery with that sort of legacy, that sort of history, you start out learning and understanding what the historical wine style is, where it fits in the pantheon of great Napa Valley wines. Change is sort of evolutionary. It's not immediate and it's not that quick. That said, I think, wine certainly reflects the personality of people that are involved in it. And so there is always kind of this evolution. The wheels keep spinning and you have an idea of wines that you want to make and a style that you want to be, what you want to bring to this particular winery. But I think it's, with time you learn, you don't want to change it all at once, right? It's got to be a slow, steady, incremental change.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And also there'd be an arrogance if you stepped in and go, all right, we're changing everything. It's Nate's time to shine. How would you describe a good bottle, a good glass of Beaulieu Cabernet Sauvignon? What are the markers for it? What are you looking to achieve?
So I think for me, the George de la Tour, which is our flagship, like that's the wine that we're really proud of, we're incredibly focused on. That's really the hallmark of BV. To me, you know, there's this idea of Rutherford dust, which was something that Andrei Chelyachev sort of coined the term, but there is something special about the tannin structure to wines that are grown here, right outside my door here in this Rutherford AVA, especially on the western side, which is where we farm a lot of our vineyards, where it has these alluvial fans and the deep fertile but also very gravelly soil. There's some unique sort of texture that comes out of that into the wines. So I think that's certainly part of the foundation of Georges de la Tour. And then I think aromatically for me, I think nuance and complexity, we get a lot of nice fruit. You know, Napa Valley certainly is known for having great fruit in Cabernet Sauvignon, but I'm a big fan of also having this nuanced character of tobacco, a little bit of herbaceousness, you know, these things that come with Cabernet Sauvignon that just add complexity, and they add interest and intrigue to the person that's smelling it, you know, making you want to come back and back and back. So really, to me, Georges de la Tour has to have all of those things.
It's funny about Rutherford dust. I remember doing WSET courses, and you learn that early on, and you can certainly tell. Like, I was touring around Napa, and the Beaulieu wines, they were different. Like, and I'm not, the reason that I want to do this interview was big fan of the wines. I could only bring so much back to Canada. I have one of your bottles sitting somewhere in a wine fridge that I'm hoping to forget that I have. Can you explain a little bit more about, if you were teaching a class, because I know you're big into mentorship, if you were explaining Rutherford dust, what would be the best way to describe it?
We have AVAs, sub-appellations up in the mountains, you know, places like Howl Mountain, Spring Mountain, Mount Beater, Atlas Peak, et cetera. And those are, you know, those structures are powerful. They're big, burly. They've got a lot of tannin. They're beautiful wines, and they age beautifully. Rutherford, especially where we farm, it's much lower elevation. We're on the valley floor, but we're in these fans, which create a little bit different texture. So I would call it the tannins are present. They're very tactile. You know they're there, but they're not overpowering. So there's something really, really special and unique, I think, to a couple of these mid-valley AVAs that have this sort of same soil structure and character. But for me, you know, Rutherford dust especially is just all, it's all that textural tannin quality where it's, you know, there's presence to it. It certainly is reminding you that's a Cabernet Sauvignon, but it's not overpowering. It's not drying. There's like almost a sweetness to it in a way.
That's funny. Talking to a lot of cab producers, I think sometimes they sum it up in terms of what they want in their wine. They want everyone to want that second glass, that the first glass wasn't heavy, that the second glass, just there's still this freshness and, this acidity to it that made you want that second glass.
Yeah, and that's kind of hard to describe, right? But I think you and I probably can both imagine it. We're sitting here thinking about it, about what that really means when you're drinking a bottle of wine, where you just want to go back for that second glass. And not every wine has it. You know, you can certainly recognize it when you don't see it there. But yeah, I think freshness is a big part of that, and purity. There's purity to the aromatics. There's purity to the fruit and everything else that comes with that.
Off topic from California for a second, but still about you, Nate. I heard, did you do some work in Hawke's Bay in North Island, New Zealand?
I sure did, longer ago than I care to admit, but yes, I did.
All right, give me at least a minute, because it's a very special place in my heart. I was there back in 2017. What is it about that area with the Syrahs or the Bordeaux blends that just, I mean, it's a great area and they make killer wine.
Yeah, so I went there when I was probably 23-ish, and I think it was really my first real trip outside the country, honestly. It was the first time I ever had a passport, was going to work for 6 months in Hawke's Bay, and showed up with a duffel bag. You know, it was a formative time in my life as well, because it was just a great adventure for me. And I worked at a place called Craigie Range, which
Of
is,
course.
I'm sure you know if you've been to Hawke's Bay, which is a beautiful, beautiful site out by the coast. And they grow a lot of grapes in the Gimlet Gravels area, which is like this really neat, basically an old riverbed that used to be a quarry, and people said, hey, this would be a great place to grow vines. And the Syrahs especially, I thought, were some of the most interesting and captivating and unique Syrahs made in the world. You know, they had kind of that Côte Rôti spice to them. There was the black pepper, really just interesting wines with lots of character. And the Bordeaux varieties, you know, they were trying hard. I think Merlot does great there. You know, it's kind of a cooler environment. So some vintages for Cabernet were quite good and some not so much. But I still remember touring around to all the different wineries in the area that made Bordeaux varieties. And a few of them still stick with me, like the Tomata Coleraine, which I don't know if you visited there, but
Waiheke
beautiful,
Island.
beautiful Cabernet.
So
Waiheke
good.
Island, for example. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's still something I look back on as an incredible time in my life. For one, a place where I learned a ton. I really got great mentorship there from a person that was running that winery. And so learning a lot about these international wine styles in a completely different climate with completely different soils than we have here, which is, I think, what makes the wine world so beautiful.
Everything is different. You're always going to be learning. I love the fact the first time you got your passport, you decided to go to the furthest corner of planet Earth, but a little easier to get there from from that part of California than it is from Toronto. Speaking of learning, I should have asked this earlier, Nate. I'm wondering what lessons, did you learn from your father in terms of winemaking?
Oh, you know, I was when I worked for him as a cellar rat, I was still so early on that I didn't, you know, I didn't know up from down or left from right. So I was really learning the basics of like this is how wine's made. This is step one, step two. You know, we bring in the grapes, we crush them. This is how a press works. This is the equipment that we use in the winery. So that was pretty basic stuff. I was too green to learn any of the nuance of the craft. But I'll never forget this story, which was when I got my first big break with Antinori. I was about ready to do my first wine dinner ever. The first time I'd ever, you know, stood in front of people and had to present a wine that I was involved in. So I was quite nervous and all this. And he came over to my house, and it was probably a Wednesday night or something like that. And I was sitting at my kitchen table, and I had my notebook out, and I was making notes. And he comes over and he goes, "Hey, what are you doing?" I said, "Oh, you know, I've got a wine dinner on Friday night, and I forget where it was exactly. And I just want to be sure I have all my information straight." And he goes, "Yeah, but like, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm making notes about, I want to make sure that the blends correctly and all the technical information and all this." And he goes, "Hey, can I give you some advice?" I said, "Of course, yeah." He said, "Look, you're not there to pass on this sort of technical information. You know, these people are, they're leaving the kids at home. They're going out for date nights. They're going to a restaurant. They want to have a great meal. They want to taste some great wines." I said, "You're the entertainment tonight. So your job is not to pass on stuff like pH or alcohol levels or blends. And, you know, nobody wants to hear 83% this and so on." He said, they want you to entertain them for the evening. And that's really stuck with me ever since, in that, you know, this is really wine's celebratory. It's not a technical thing that we want to give details about. It's really part of people's lives and celebrating these moments. And that's really stuck with me ever since.
Yeah, wine are stories and wine are moments. My encounter with your vineyard, part of my 50th birthday, the staff there was fantastic. I remember where I was sitting, my girlfriend, where her twin sister was sitting. I remember the other people that were there. I remember how nice everyone was to let us in and just getting to try some of the higher end wines, which I never did until that day. And then it all made sense. I'm like, oh, now I get why this wine is so celebrated. And it's true. Everyone, the story, it's so funny. Story sells wine far more than which Cooper you're using for your new French oak.
Absolutely. And connection, which it sounds like you got, which was person to person, just making that connection between us, right?
How important is mentorship for you in terms of helping with the next generation? I read that you were a faculty member at the Napa Valley College and just sharing expertise. How important is that for you?
Well, I suppose, you know, at this point in my life, you know, it's I'm not on the downward part of my career, but I'm
No.
certainly not the start either. And so at some point I realized really what my job is to give a little bit back to this industry. So for me, mentorship's kind of what it's all about. Like the ability to teach classes and kind of influence the next generation of winemakers and grape growers coming up and help them navigate their careers and what this kind of crazy wine world actually looks like. It's it's really important. And one of the things I've learned in my career as well is that the team building and the culture you build at the winery, it really does show through in the wines, right? So we have a team of people that work in the cellar and winemaking, and people that make sure the bills get paid and the equipment still runs. You know, we all have to work together as a team to make sure that everything goes as it should. And so I think this idea of kind of creating that environment for ourselves, and it just makes it a lot of fun, right? And so for me, you know, it's my little way of trying to give back to this industry that's given me so much.
Yeah, I think you're about 15 years away from, you know, wise old mentor. I'm gonna go 15, 20 years minimum, you know, before you're there. Do you have, I always love asking the war stories. Do you have a toughest vintage? It could be with Beaulieu, could be with somewhere else. Do you have one vintage that just kept you up the most at night?
Let's see. That's a good question. You know, 2011 was a fairly challenging one here in Napa Valley. We don't get a lot of vintages that have, you know, mid-season rain and disease pressure and stuff like that. So that was really the first time I'd ever seen that in my career, and I was only a couple years into kind of being the person running the show. So there was a lot of learning in that and a lot of unknown. I think that's always the challenge is the unknown of what's going to happen. So if you have At the time, I was making a lot of barrel fermented Chardonnay, and we were seeing a lot of botrytis on the Chardonnay coming in. And is this sort of a ticking time bomb, or is this going to be okay? And but I think what it a lot of my career has helped teach me is that you can't worry about these things that you don't know, right? You've got to, our whole job is making decisions with incomplete information. And that's kind of what we do on a daily basis. And so you learn to get more and more comfortable with that and just responding to what nature gives you all the time. But that was a fairly difficult one, I recall. And a lot of the things that I didn't know, and I didn't know how they were going to work out, those were the things that kept me up at night for sure.
Yeah, well, it's and but then obviously you learn from it, and but of course being a winemaker means you have to say goodbye to having a sense of control. You don't have a lot of control. You just watch the weather channel and hope for the best.
That's a critical part of every winemaker's evolution is when you're young and you're full of energy and really excited about kind of these opportunities, you feel as though you should be in control of everything. And there's this epiphany moment that everybody has where you go like, this is outside of my control and I just have to sort of respond to it. And you sleep much, much better at night once you start.
Must be a weird thing because on one level, you can work really hard to try to mitigate issues through nature. So on one level, you're working really hard, checking the projections, how that impacts in the vineyard, pruning, whatever. But then on another level, you kind of have to embrace just being a leaf in the river and seeing where it takes you.
Yeah. Like, so as I was saying, incomplete information. And so you look at the weather report, you see rain in the forecast for 6 days out. And so what are you going to do? You know, are you going to bring in everything? Are you going to bring in what you think is ripe? Are you just going to wait the whole thing out? You have no idea how much rain there's going to be. That rainstorm could move up, it could move back, it could disappear entirely, it could be way worse. So it's sometimes it almost feels like gambling, honestly.
How many, I wasn't thinking of asking this, but how many people are involved? What is the decision-making process when it comes to decide when it's time to pick?
You know, I think you have to kind of on the same idea of mentorship and culture and team building is I've yet to meet a winemaker that does everything themselves. I know there's initially you want to be involved in every little decision and everything that goes on, but really you're going to be much more successful if you build a team of people around you. And when it comes to like picking grapes, you know, you the laws of physics still apply. You can only be in one place at a given time. And so the more you develop a language with people that you work with, and the more that you kind of build that trust about decision making. So I have a couple people that work with me here, Megan Twitchell and Lindsay Mongan, that both, you know, I have complete trust in to go out into a vineyard and say, look, this vineyard's ready. We should pick it, or not quite yet, or whatever. And I think that leads in general to better decision making because if you're gonna hold it that close to the vest and you want to do it all yourself, you know, you're sort of limited in the amount of ground you can cover in a given day, right?
Did I read correctly? Do you have four kids?
I do have four kids.
You have four kids. You're the general manager and senior winemaker for a very prestigious Napa vineyard at Beaulieu. How many hours of sleep do you get? Like, what's the period where Nate gets the least amount of sleep?
Oh, certainly harvest. You know, harvest is, I think you do this long enough, and you're become an early riser in general. So usually I'm up and out by 5-ish, 5:30, something like that. But during harvest, you know, our picks will often start at midnight or 2 a.m. So sometimes there are earlier mornings during harvest. At the same time, you know, you can't sacrifice things like sleep. So I think it's also important to have that humility to say, look, man, I'm too tired. I need to go home and just crash for a while. You guys take the reins, take over this thing. We're going to be fine. So building that trust with people is important. So, you know, it's not quite as 24/7 for an individual person as you might think. That said, the operation is running basically 24/7 for about 2.5 months during harvest.
Yeah, that is a wild time of year. By the way, my recommendation, if anyone's going to visit any vineyard during harvest, just know that people you may have planned to meet, you might not be able to see them. Nate, as we end this, any message to people out there? I mean, right now in Canada, unless we go to restaurants, it's hard to access American wine. Hopefully that changes sooner rather than later. But just a message you would give to anyone listening if they're thinking of making the trip, flying to San Fran and making their way to Napa, but why they should come by and visit.
Well, nobody's more excited for that to change than us, because you guys love California wines, and we loved selling them to you. So a lot of cool stuff happened. Actually, I would highly recommend coming to visit us. We're in the midst of renovating the original Stone Winery from the 1880s. That's going to be our new hospitality space. It's been a long time coming, a big project that's taken years and years. And it's going to be open in July. And there's a lot of energy, a lot of buzz building here. For us and the rest of the valley about that, because it's very prominent. It's right there on Highway 29. And I get questions and texts every day asking me how it's going. So that's pretty exciting. You know, I think we love to host people. You know, you can look at kind of the breadth and diversity of wines we make at bbwines.com. You know, we've got quite a bit available. Many wines are available only by coming to visit us. But yeah, and we're excited about the future. There's a lot of great stuff happening at BV, and I'm pumped up about it.
Nate, really appreciate it. Congrats on the success. Congrats again on just figuring out what you wanted to do at a fairly young age and just continuing from, you know, your father did it before you. You're at a hell of a vineyard. I would, again, recommend everyone go and visit Beaulieu. Thank you so much for being on the pod today.
Matt, thank you very much. And maybe my second career will be broadcasting like yourself.
My second career will not be in winemaking. That's way too hard. I'm going to stay to my job. Being a radio gas bag, way easier than yours. Thanks again.
Cheers.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.